Hello and welcome to Food Stuff. I'm Anne Aries.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about the breadfruit.
Yeah.
Which is neither a bread nor... No, it is a fruit. Well, it's a bundle of flowers.
It's a lot of things.
That you eat.
A bundle of flowers that you eat. I hope that clears everything up, everybody.
Yep, end of the episode.
I have never had breadfruit. This is one that angry people will write about, like, I can't believe you've never had it.
Yeah, I've never had it either, so send away those angry emails.
Actually, please don't.
We will have to rectify this at the first opportunity because it sounds amazing. The story of it is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Our sister podcast, Stuff You Missed in History Class, did an episode on it a long time ago in a podcast booth far, far away, or in Buckhead.
In Buckhead, yeah.
Yeah, way back when Katie and Sarah, I think, were the hosts.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah.
That was a long podcast away.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And How Stuff Works even has a small article about it, which it would not surprise us if Ridiculous History eventually covered.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's a little bit ridiculous.
It is. If they don't invite us to cameo on that,
oh, man.
We're going to have some podcast beef.
I keep going like, hey, guys, why haven't you invited me back yet? And they're like, oh, we thought you were busy.
Oh, man. The judgmental look on your face. I can't believe they haven't quelled under the pressure.
Anyway,
yes.
The breadfruit.
What is it? How it do?
How it do? Goodness. Oh, that's a very big question.
It is.
It's a very big question for a very big fruit. The breadfruit is the fruit of a tropical flowering tree, Artocarpus altilis. And it's related to the mulberry and jackfruit. There are a couple other species under Artocarpus and a couple hundred cultivars of breadfruit. But basically, the trees range from like 20 to 80-ish feet in height. That's about 6 to 24 meters. They've got glossy green leaves. The flowers are tiny, tiny, tiny and come in these dense clusters attached to a spongy sort of spear or rod or ball. These flower spears tend to look a little bit like corn dogs or like ears of corn that have had all the kernels taken off or mm-hmm. like weird, slightly oblong golf balls.
Yeah. I have somebody somewhere. It's one of those stories that was told to me so long ago that I can't even remember who told it to me or who it was about. But I know somewhere in my past, somebody thought, like a kid, thought those little stalk spear things with the corn dog looking things on the end. He thought they were corn dogs and picked one up. He thought they grew in fields and went to eat them and was in for a shock.
That's amazing.
It is.
Well, luckily they're non-toxic, so.
Yeah, and it's a memory that to vaguely recall in the middle of a podcast.
That's delightful.
Mm-hmm.
Both male and female flowers grow on the same trees, and the female ones will develop as this cluster of thousands of flowers into a single compound fruit, sort of like the pineapple, if y'all remember that episode. Like, as they grow, all the flowers fuse together and form the part of the breadfruit that is eaten. The base of each flower fuses together to form the rind, and the resulting fruit looks like a spiny or lumpy kind of yellow-green ball or oval that can range in size and shape from something like a baseball to something like a human lung.
Ah, that's what I like to picture when I think about food.
Fruit?
Yeah.
Human lung,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
The breadfruit is also sometimes known as the tropical potato and is honestly fascinating. One of the interesting things about it is that you can eat it at any point. When it's immature, it has a flavor similar to artichoke hearts. The immature fruit can replace vegetables in a recipe and are often pickled or boiled. The mature, unripe fruit can replace potatoes in recipes, steamed, baked, or boiled. The flavor at that point is something between a potato and a plantain. But as it ripens, the texture grows more and more custard-like and can be enjoyed raw. It kind of reminds me of durian, which we do have. We're just
waiting. Yeah, we're waiting for the right time and place.
We are.
Outdoor place.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It can be enjoyed raw or cooked. Once it's ripe, it is also used in – it's frequently eaten raw, but it's also used in baked goods and other desserts. And, yes, I've heard it described as like a durian in texture, but not so garlic funky.
Not so durian in taste.
Flavor, yeah. Sort of just nice and sweet, maybe a little bit tart, like maybe a little bit of pineapple kind of flavor in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ooh. Once ripe, it does rot fairly quickly, and researchers are looking into ways to extend its shelf life by drying and shredding it.
Some varieties have seeds that are edible and apparently similar in flavor and texture to chestnuts that can be roasted or boiled or ground to make a sort of meal.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
And the male flowers themselves, those corn dog things, are sometimes candied and eaten.
Those corn dog things. You know, those things.
Those things.
Despite sharing the texture of a potato and having a high carb count, the breadfruit itself is gluten-free.
Just about all fruit, vegetables, and grains, except for wheat, barley, and rye, and some specific things like glutinous rice, are gluten-free.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And boy, howdy, are they nutritious. Calcium, copper, fibery stuff, iron, magnesium, niacin, omega-3, omega-6, phosphorus, potassium, thiamine, vitamins A and C. A mere half cup will give you 5 to 10% of your recommended daily allowance of protein and 25% of your RDA of fiber. And Hawaii's Breadfruit Institute of the National Tropical Botanical Garden lists multitudes of ways to eat breadfruit. In casseroles, in a type of potato salad, curries, pancakes, breads, fritters, chowders, dips, a veggie burger, pate, chips, nachos, alongside corned beef, in beverages, in flans. You can also put it through a food processor to make a dough substitute.
Yeah. Dried and ground breadfruit flour can be used to make everything from, like, tortillas to bread to pastries. And it, of course, can also be fermented into alcoholic beverages of various kinds.
Of course. And if you aren't impressed already, the breadfruit has other uses. The male breadfruit and leaves are a great insect repellent when burned. The sap is great for caulking and as a chewing gum. I'm very intrigued by that.
Oh, yeah. It's like a latex kind of stuff.
Oh.
Yeah.
Hmm. The bark can be used as a fabric, and fallen fruits and leaves can be used in animal feed. So lots of things going for the breadfruit.
Absolutely.
If we look at some numbers, a breadfruit tree can produce an annual 50 to 150 fruits, which is one of the highest yielding crops in existence. The fruit itself can weigh up to 12 pounds, about 5.5 kilograms, while the tree can reach 85 feet or 26 meters.
Or even bigger. I've read all kinds of reports about they can last a long time and get pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
And they are self-propagating. You don't need seeds in order to grow new breadfruit. New saplings grow up from shoots off of established trees. It will take a few years for a new tree to mature, but once it does, it will fruit for dozens or even hundreds of years.
Yep. And breadfruit is grown in over 90 different countries, and in the Pacific Islands, more breadfruit are grown per hectare than rice, wheat, and corn.
Dang.
Dang, indeed. Got so excited I gesticulated and hit the mic stand.
It's that level of excitement in here, folks.
It really is.
We're going to get into some of the history of the breadfruit, including a famous mutiny.
Yeah.
But first, we're going to get into a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Breadfruit originated about 3,000 years ago in the area that is now New Guinea. In 300 CE, breadfruit, along with coconut, sweet potatoes, ginger, and bananas, arrived to Hawaii via Polynesia as a canoe fruit. Ancient Hawaiians believed the breadfruit to be sacred. They called it ulu. They planted so many breadfruit trees that some groves could feed 75,000 people. The plant provided raw materials like wood, obviously, but also was used for crafts and medicine. And breadfruit remains a culturally significant staple food in the South Pacific.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uru are still Hawaiian terms for the fruit used today.
Mm-hmm. And the French Polynesians have a legend about a famine that occurred. A family of six was living in a cave and were desperately hungry, enough so they were eating ferns. The father, miserable at watching his family wasting away, buried himself in the cave, promising his wife he'd transform into a tree, bearing fruit to feed his family. Sure enough, when his wife woke up the next morning, there was a breadfruit tree, an uru tree. That area is now sometimes referred to as Tua Uru, the Valley of the Breadfruit. Some locals give uru another name, the Tree of Life. It spread throughout the Pacific from New Guinea. And when the Europeans discovered it in the 1500s, they were amazed at the bread-like texture and smell of roasted breadfruit, hence the name.
Pretty much all of the European languages use a word for bread in their name for breadfruit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So about that mutiny.
Yeah.
Well, first, before we get there, along comes Captain James Cook in 1796. After making landfall in Tahiti, Cook and his companion, Sir Joseph Banks, stumbled upon breadfruit and realized that it could be a useful crop in places with similar tropical climates, a.k.a. colonies that were producing sugarcane.
Yeah.
Banks thought the prolific trees would be an excellent and inexpensive source of food for the enslaved peoples living in the Caribbean colonies. Yeah, that were making this whole sugarcane thing happen. So convinced was Banks of the value of his idea that he presented it to King George III saying, quote, "Regarding food, if a man planted 10 breadfruit trees in his life, he would completely fulfill his duty to his own as well as future generations." He requested a special expedition with the sole purpose of retrieving breadfruit trees and replanting them in the Caribbean. And of note, Banks was the president of the Royal Society at the time and a patron of Kew Gardens.
He's sometimes credited with being one of the architects of globalization.
So, big, big dude.
Yeah, big deal.
Big historical fellow.
Mm-hmm.
His request was granted. Huzzah! Perhaps not.
Not huzzah?
Not huzzah. Perhaps not. William Bligh was made captain of the HMS Bounty in 1787. And his mission from the Royal Crown? To transport 1,000 Tahitian breadfruit trees to the Caribbean with the intention of using the highly nutritious and energy-boosting food to feed British slaves. But all was not well on the Bounty.
Mm-mm.
One journal described Bligh as brutal. It took 10 months for the mostly healthy crew to arrive to Tahiti, behind schedule enough that they missed their window for transplanting the trees. So they had to hang around for another 5 months. A lot of the crew, of course, found themselves Tahitian mistresses. When the time came to leave, a lot of the crew wasn't on board. But Bligh made them get on board, literally, unaware or uncaring of the resentment of his crew.
And some stories say that part of the problem was that Bligh was rationing out a short supply of water on board and, like, favoring the trees over the crewmen, which led to not less resentment.
Oh, sure. I can imagine.
Yeah.
So the crew mutinied. Several men armed with bayonets broke into Bligh's cabin one night, binding his hands behind his back and bringing him up to the deck wearing only a shirt. Bligh demanded to know the reason behind the mutiny, and the only response he got was, "I have been in hell for the last fortnight, sir. In hell." Aw. No. Okay. Of note, the Marlon Brando played that guy in the 1962 movie about this, and I really missed an opportunity to do a Marlon Brando accent, but it's for the best, just for everybody. I would have had fun, but no one else would have had fun.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I can admit what accents I can do and can't do, and this is really not an accent. It's an impersonation. But either way, it would have been a failure for all to hear.
You can check out the film Mutiny on the Bounty.
You can.
If you want to hear it for yourself, not through the filter of Annie.
Yes. You absolutely can do that. Bligh and 18 others were forced overboard in a longboat. The mutineers sent them on their way with some pork, biscuits, water, and 6 quarts of rum. All 1,000 trees went into the water. Twist.
Oh.
Yeah, I guess they were pretty mad about that water rationing thing, if it's true.
They were like, screw these trees, we're going back to Tahiti.
Take that, trees.
And they did.
And they did. But Bligh and his mini crew were wily, and in what is called one of the greatest feats of seamanship of all time, they managed to navigate their ship through mostly uncharted water without a map or a compass to Timor, making an early stop at one of the Friendly Islands. That's what they were called. Not that the islands, like, were friendly.
Because they weren't.
No, because the indigenous peoples chased them away with rocks and killed one man. The crew decided to make minimal stops after that, and food was strictly rationed. 2 ounces of biscuit and a little water a day. And every now and then they got some pork. Every now and then they got some rum. The journey took 47 days through heavy storms, and they covered 6,701 kilometers, or 4,164 miles. They stopped at Koh Phang, starving, sleep-deprived, and that's where three of the crew died of fever.
Oh,
like, not
man.
On the whole journey.
They made it there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
From there, they made their way back to Britain and commissioned a second trip, this time on the HMS Providence. No mutinies were had, and 5 years after his first mission failed, Bligh succeeded. Or mostly. Many of the 2,000 breadfruit trees on the ship died due to flies, cold, or the, quote, unwholesomeness of sea air.
Hmm.
678 breadfruit trees arrived in the West Indies. And a few of those trees first planted 200 years ago in Jamaica bear fruit to this day.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The locals did resist it at first, though, eating it only when other options were limited. It took 40 years for them to develop a taste for the breadfruit.
Yeah, the population of Jamaica fed it to pigs at first. To be fair, the mature but unripe fruit is kind of bland and can be described as, like, mealy. Mm-hmm. And it can go pretty mushy if you overcook it.
Mm-hmm.
Once you figure out how to deal with it, though, apparently it's great.
It sounds amazing. These days, scientists think the breadfruit could be useful in the fight against hunger. After all, there is a tradition in parts of Polynesia to plant a breadfruit tree when a child is born to guarantee that they won't go hungry.
Oh.
Since the 1980s, a researcher out of Hawaii National Tropical Botanical Garden, NTBG, Diane Ragone, followed the DNA breadcrumbs of breadfruit all the way back to parasite breadfruit. I mean, the first. They call it Eve.
Oh.
Breadfruit Eve. I'm going to try to get as many Parasite Eve references in this show as I can.
So far, you are succeeding.
Who knew?
You're really doing it.
Thank you, Lauren.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. In 2003, Ragone helped found the Breadfruit Institute at the National Tropical Botanical Garden. And yeah, the institute is partnered with the charity Alliance to End Hunger to bring the breadfruit to areas in need.
Scientists are also working to find the species that contains the most protein and also the ones that are most accepting of salt as sea levels rise.
Ragone and her fellow researchers say that this one cultivar from Samoa surpasses soybeans in terms of protein content and quality. And yeah, they're hoping that this kind of research could help places like Hawaii that currently import over half of their food become more self-sustainable.
In 2009, Josh Schneider launched an initiative to put breadfruit trees all over the world called Global Breadfruit. The group put 14,000 trees in 10 different countries in 2016. A Costa Rican native, Diana Chavez, took some of the breadfruit from the trees the organization planted and started making chips out of the fruit and putting them in grocery stores.
Yeah, like fried chips are one of the most popular mm-hmm. ways to eat. I mean, once you fry anything, it's pretty great.
Yeah.
But apparently they're super delicious.
Apparently. She gets a lot of requests for them now.
Yeah.
At first she had trouble selling them, and now people are like, where are the chips?
More breadfruit chips!
Yeah.
I need them!
Mm-hmm.
In 2010, the Breadfruit Institute partnered with the Global Hunger Initiative, which distributed 90,000 trees to 40 countries over the next 5 years. And in 2016, the FDA ruled breadfruit flour safe for consumption here in the United States. So
right.
You might see it out there in your gluten-free baking aisle.
You just might.
Mm-hmm.
So it's had a really fascinating just story behind the breadfruit.
Yeah, yes. It's a little bit more hopeful than a lot of the tropical fruits that we discuss on this show.
This is true.
Yeah. And we've got a little bit more left in this episode today, but first, we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes.
So, by a little bit more in this episode, I meant mostly
listener mail.
Ah.
Yeah. I feel like we were jack in the box in that one.
I was like, are we cheerleading? You sure?
We have to communicate through body language. And sometimes the communication, the message gets lost. But
it's like a game of telephone. I don't know. Like, I was picking up something.
Yeah. What? Good question. But something. Okay. So Sarah wrote, first, I did not eat a hot dog this 4th of July, even though I really wanted to. I decided to make it my cheat day and take full advantage of it, so I made rib dogs.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Basically just hot dog buns with slow-cooked barbecue ribs, bone removed in them.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and she attached photos, and they look amazing.
Oh, heck.
The sauce smeared on the buns was made of yogurt and wasabi and yogurt and Dijon. Any strong-flavored condiment mixed with yogurt can make a legit low-cal dip. Totally holds up. She also wrote in about the discrepancy between, we didn't mention this because I totally forgot about it, but how hot dogs come in tens and buns comes in eights.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But she continues, everyone who grew up in China is familiar with our version of hot dogs, which, I kid you not, is so much better than the garden variety Franks. Sorry, not sorry. They're called huo tui chong, which literally translates to ham sausage. They're like Spam made into hot dogs without the edible casing, but firmer and less mushy than Spam. They come in this red wrapper with a metal ring on each end. This is a staple in literally every Chinese household, at least during my generation. They're good for everything. Sautéed, thrown into whatever soups, jian bing, which are Chinese crepes recently caught on here in the New York City food scene, known as Bing, as snacks eaten just by themselves, picnic food, literally everything. I remember every time we had a field trip or a family outing, these things were always there. And one of the most common uses that'll trigger so many Chinese people's memories is having them in instant ramen noodles. It's as common as having cheese on your burgers. The metal ring can be a challenge to take off. So a lazy way is to twist it in the middle as if you're wringing a towel. It'll divide into two little sausages, and the middle part of the wrapper should be easily ripped. Then you suck the sausage out of the wrapper bit by bit, like with Freezy Pops. Or eat it like a normal human being, peeling the wrapper off. And she sent us some, and we have them here in the studio.
Yeah. Oh, it's, yeah, we got this package of these. Yeah.
We got them this very day, correct?
Sometime, yes, soonish.
Soonish.
Relatively close to this time that we are recording this episode.
Yes.
That was definitely a sentence, y'all. We're gonna
leave
please
it in
bear
there
with me. We're gonna stick through it.
We're gonna stick the landing.
Yeah, thank you so much. They're very brightly colored, and I am excited to eat one.
Yeah, there's a lion on the front.
I'm excited to eat all of them, actually.
I
didn't get a hot dog either for...
Oh, my gosh.
For 4th of July.
So I... Yep. Okay. I mentioned in the episode we did on hot dogs that I have, like, two a year. I ran that race.
The Peachtree 10K.
The Peachtree 10K.
Uh-huh, which is a 4th of July race, right?
Yes. And I got... I didn't know this at the time, but I got heat exhaustion.
Oh.
I finished the race, and I got a really good time, but I got heat exhaustion. And there was no food at my house. And I was, like, could not... get up from the couch, and my friend went and bought me a package of hot dogs, and she cooked them all, and I just, like, I didn't put them in buns. I just ate
them. You
just
ate the hot dogs.
Like, one after the other, and I think I had six. It was a lot of hot dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I texted you about it.
You did. Did you have a relatively enjoyable experience doing it?
Oh, yeah. They were great.
Well, there you go. See?
Yeah.
Happy ending.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I guess you kind of, like, made up for my lack of hot dogs.
Yeah, I suppose we balance each other out. But we do have this now. We're very excited to try it. I can't believe I probably did see these in China. I just didn't know what they were. Because they kind of look like cigars.
Sure. Or, like, jerky?
Yeah.
Like, they remind me more of, like, a jerky because, yeah, they're in these long tubes. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. A second Sarah wrote in, I'm a native Ohioan, but spent the past year living in South Dakota. There was a restaurant in the lobby of my office building that had authentic Skyline chili for reasons entirely unclear to me, as nobody there was from outside of South Dakota. They had a Skyline-topped hot dog listed on the menu as a chili dog that I would sometimes order for a dose of nostalgia and indigestion when I was feeling particularly homesick. One day, they had a baseball special advertised on their board, described as a Coney dog with chips. They had been out of the chili for months, and I was so excited at the prospect of having a Skyline dog again that I immediately ordered one. They asked what I wanted on it, and I said the chili was fine. They explained that they were really sorry, but they had been out of chili and unable to order more for a while. I questioned why on earth they would have a daily special based completely around a menu item they were unable to order, and they were baffled. They explained that I was still able to get a hot dog, I just couldn't get chili on it. Nearly half an hour later, we discovered that they thought Coney was just another name for a plain hot dog and didn't realize it had anything to do with a chili topping. I never realized I had such passionate opinions about hot dogs until forced to explain that a Coney is a very specific type of hot dog, and if you're advertising it, you better make sure it has some kind of meat sauce on it or else. I was so scandalized, and my husband, a South Dakota native who has been thoroughly educated on the delights of Skyline Chili, Coney dogs, and other Ohio delicacies, was so entertained.
That's pretty hilarious. There's so many different types of hot dogs. I wouldn't have known. I think the subject line of this email was like a Coney. What exactly is a Coney anyway? Who knows? Sarah does, apparently.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. I feel like the term Coney in my research about hot dogs could be used to describe a number of different hot dog configurations. Like, there were, like, different regional Coneys.
Oh, boy. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, man, I'm not going to...
Not going to touch this.
Yeah. No, I backed away slowly from that one. It's like, I'm going to get myself in trouble.
From this message, I would say that's probably accurate. I love it. I love... how people have, like...
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful.
It really is.
Yeah. And certainly, I've never seen the term Coney applied to a plain hot dog, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a risky move, advertising-wise.
Yeah. But thank you so much to both of them for writing in. If you would like to do that thing, you can.
Our email is foodstuff@howstuffworks.com.
We're also on social media... you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at FoodstuffHSW, also on Instagram at Foodstuff. We do hope to hear from you. Thanks, as always, to our amazing super producer, Dylan K. Fagan. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.